Welcome to Cabronas y Chingonas, a podcast where we talk about queer and Latinx topics such as...
The TV show Luis Miguel, especially the main character, ese güey siempre está en calzones or like naked in every fucking episode. So...
That's queer culture.
You gotta love it. Hashtag bless Mexico closet gay. I don't know what I'm saying.
Isn't Ana Bárbara another famous closeted person?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I know Lucía, Daniela Romo, Verónica Castro.
Oh, I didn't know about those.
Girl, they're fucking power gays in Mexico.
Damn. We need to, like, go on an investigation.
Y Ana Gabriel.
I think so, yeah.
What up, Maite?
How are you?
I am excited.
I am too, and a little bit nervous.
Why are you nervous?
I don't know. I just... It's like being in front of, you know, a star.
Ay, güey. Now you're going to make me nervous.
¿Cómo brillas?
I'm so excited because, like, you guys' podcast is one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh, my God. Likewise.
I remember listening to you guys for the first time, and I was fucking dying. I remember where I was driving. I remember the street where I was driving when I was listening to you guys. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? This is awesome. That was a long time ago. That was when you guys first started.
Yeah, like a good year ago.
Yeah. So I'm very ecstatic. We've been talking about doing this episode for a while. So here we are. Let's go. Let's do it.
Like, it really has been a long time coming. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy that we had Fabi Fab from Latinos Who Lunch. Yeah. This is, by the way, for those two of you that don't know, this is Pablito from Latinos Who Lunch here in the studio. And we had Fabi Fab a long time ago, and we were so sad to be missing you that day. So finally, everything comes full circle.
Yes, and check out Latinos Who Lunch episode with Maite, which I'm guessing is going to come out after this.
So yeah.
You'll keep your listeners.
Yeah, as soon as we have it, we'll be posting it on our social media and on our website. So,
because we got into it, so I'm very excited about that episode.
Me too. I didn't know what we were going to record about, but it turned out pretty nice.
I mean, that's the thing. Everybody's always like, what are we going to talk about? I'm like, don't worry. Just come. And we'll take care of it.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, and I mean, we will have to prepare for a guest that we might not know, so maybe a specific topic. But when you're family, when you're friend, it's like, it's no big deal. We got it.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for on this one. Because even though it's been a long time coming, when I prepared for this podcast, it was like 7 months ago.
Damn.
I was looking at my notes. I was like, oh, this was 7 months ago that I planned this episode.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm ready, so.
I'm ready, too. But before we get into, like, some of the things that I really want to talk about, I want to learn a little bit more about you, which I know about 56 hours worth already, but but I still want to let our listeners know a little bit of back history on you.
Okay, so I'm Babelito. Well, my real name is Emmanuel Ortega. I was born here in Los Angeles, California. And when I was 5 months old, my family decided to move back to Mexico, thank God. So I was able to grow up in Juarez. So I was there till I was like 14 years old. We moved to El Paso, Texas for 2 years. And that was interesting. I think the whole entire family went into a collective depression because we went from like the fourth largest city in Mexico to like one of the smallest ones in the States.
Shout out to Texas.
And it was different. It was like a different pace, a different way of life, and we just couldn't adapt. So at the time in the late 90s, there was a boom of construction in Las Vegas. So my dad is a construction worker. He decided to try it out. He moved to Las Vegas for 6 months and he loved it. And he said, we all go into Las Vegas. And the first night we were in Las Vegas, we're like, there's people walking in the street. This is awesome. So we moved there in 98. I was there till 2007 when I decided to go to grad school in New Mexico. I moved to New Mexico for 4 years, got my master's and got candidacy and became a PhD candidate. And then we moved back to Vegas. I lived there for several years. And in 2016, I moved back to Albuquerque to finish my PhD. My PhD is in Ibero-American colonial art history. It's very specific.
Say that three times fast.
Ibero-American colonial art history, Bear American culinary art history. Yeah, Bear American culinary art history. You know what my sister does?
What?
She does this thing when she wants to calm herself and she's laughing too much. She goes, yo soy una persona muy seria, pero tan seria que puedo decir tres veces sin reírme, tururú pajarito, tururú pajarito, tururú pajarito. And then she breathes.
That's amazing.
So that's what I say. Anyway, so my concentration is on images of race, gender, and class difference and violence in the colonial period. In 2008, there was a lot of destruction and a lot of violence in my city, Juarez. And actually, it's not too different right now. But I couldn't understand or make sense of the circulation of images of violence, of decapitados and all kinds of things like that in popular media in Juarez, to the point that my family was engaging with it. And I was like, why? What is our drive? So instead of trying to articulate and quantify human cruelty, I decided to go to the root and look into the historical context of those images. And that's when I got into colonial art. And then I study images of the Inquisition, I study images of martyrs, and that's what I still do. Right now I'm working on a project that involves the history of sentimentality in Mexico. So I'm, in a way, creating my own methodology, and I'm starting this whole new thing to explain why we're so, like, somos super románticos, es super, we're like telenovelescos, like it's in our blood, like listen to Jose Jose, listen to Luis Miguel, watch a soap opera or a movie from the 40s and 50s. That is a form of cultural creation that started in Mexico in the 18th century. So I'm tracing the steps in literature and in art, and how do we got to this point where we're just like so dramatic about everything.
That's so freaking fascinating. Yeah. Are you kidding? That's really, really cool. Like, I remember, I think it was a movie like Interstellar or something that made me like think about something like, as humans, like there's a lot of shit about us that is very predictable, mm-hmm. like biologically and shit like that. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that doesn't make sense is how we miss people when they die, mm-hmm. because that doesn't benefit us in any way. Mm-hmm. So to me, that ties into romanticism. It's like, yeah. Why are we so emotional about these things? So I'm very curious to see what you'll find.
Everything has a root, like the way that we romanticize children, for example, how children are the vehicle for a lot of adult problems. Think about the kids right now stuck in the border, and how this kind of things have been happening for a long time, and now we're paying attention because kids are involved. There's certain bodies that become vehicles for those things. So right. Like the sentimentality of death has a lot to do with our attachment to children. That's why we're obsessed with abortion, for example. The same thing with Trayvon Martin.
Yeah.
Yes, Trayvon Martin. And he basically carried to his grave the weight of our racial problems in this country. And it's always been like that. In Mexico, we've been obsessed with death for a long, long time.
Yeah,
from absolutely. The pre-Columbian period. But it really gets institutionalized into almost like law when it comes to the colonial period. All of those things are part of... Right now, I'm putting together the class. So, for example, we're going to spend one class just talking about dead babies. Because there's a como una costumbre of painting dead babies in colonial paintings. And they're just like laying there with their eyes closed and full of flowers. And there's a history of that also in 19th century photography. So there's a lot of things written in American art, in US art, but nobody has done anything related to that in Mexico. So what I'm doing is I'm using American art history as a methodology to build this whole entire thing in Mexico. And there's so many themes, like themes of women reading letters, themes of dead children, themes of romantic images of war. And all of that gets solidified in movies in the 1950s. A lot of themes about race, class, and gender that are very sentimentalized, they become truth in film and in soap operas. So that's why I'm obsessed with Latin American TV, because I see some tropes that you still see in TV today, they started fucking like 500 years ago. Like, ugh, the Spanish fucked everything up. But yes.
Yeah, I've been noticing, like, very frequently you're watching these older, like, Mexican films, like, really, really often. And I was like, what is it? Like, what is attracting his attention to it? But, I mean, this kind of makes sense.
Yeah, when I met my boo, we started talking about symbols of the nation and how the nation, in a way, has been constructed through images. And he goes, I have a movie for you to watch, because he's a film major. Mm-hmm. And so he showed me this movie called Rio Escondido. Girl, the movie starts with a scene of Maria Félix observing the murals of La Historia de México by Diego Rivera, totally romanticizing. And then she talks to el presidente de la República, and then she goes to save kids in el pueblo, you know, and like super romantic ideas about education and the nation and patriotismo. And I was like, oh my God, it's like I'm watching a series of colonial paintings, but now they're in movement. And I got stuck to the point that we watch movies pretty much every day when we're together, because we're doing a little bit of long distance. And Mexican cinema from the 1940s and 1950s is going to be one chapter in my book, because there's just so many themes. And I was watching a scene from Marimar.
Oh my God, yeah.
And it's like Marimar, you know, like the character, she talks like, oh, he has this like ridiculous coast accent. Mm-hmm. And you have the rich guy and the poor girl. I was watching this scene and this interaction, and I swear I was watching Tizoc. And Tizoc is a movie with Pedro Infante and Maria Félix. And it's the same idea of like, yo te vengo a salvar, I'm going to save you. You're indigenous, I'm rich, God, yeah. I'm Spanish, we're going to fall in love, Hakuna Matata, everything's going to be great. Those are themes that start in the colonial period, that transfer to paintings in the 19th century, that become moving images in film in the 1940s, and they're part of the popular imagination with telenovelas in the 1980s and 90s, and to a certain point still today. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
Yeah, telenovelas is something that I really want to just jump into sometimes, because like I feel like I haven't seen enough of it or studied it for long enough that I can like really like understand it. And you know, novelas fucking, they have like 1,000 episodes each, so yeah. It's so hard to like binge it like I normally would in a show that mm-hmm. I want to turn into a case study, but yeah, novelas are so interesting. There's one that I did actually watch recently called Mi Familia Perfecta, but that one was easy. Uh-huh. And like, yeah, there's still so much, like, they're obsessed with classism. Like, yes. Classism, they're obsessed with it. That's the one thing, anybody can see that.
But that's because in the colonial period it was institutionalized. In the 1700s, there was a boom of scientific exploration throughout Europe, and Spain saw themselves as the retrogrades, and the rest of Europe saw Spain as a retrograde. So Spain had to prove to the rest of Europe that they were badasses. They were like leaders of the Enlightenment. So they created universities, they solidified the caste system. So according to how much Spanish, Black, Asian, and European blood you had, you will be assigned a different caste. And the more Spanish blood you had, the better caste you had, the better rights you had. So class is entrenched with race, is entrenched with ideas of education, so many different things. So when we think about race in Mexico, we have to think about class. Here in the States is different. We have been reduced to a binary system of black and white. Right? And in Mexico, it's not like that. In Mexico, it's about class. You can have class, but no money.
Right.
But that's because the way that it was established in the colonial period. And those traumas and anxieties still continue in telenovelas. So that's why everybody's obsessed with money and class. And even when you might not have the money, you might have the class, you know? Because you could have fakely bought your class, or your family comes from a quote-unquote good family, whatever that means, you know? So it's very complicated. And for us, it's just like, oh, yeah, you see it in a soap opera. But when people approach it from another country, they're like, what the fuck are we watching? It's so interesting to see soap operas with people that are not used to watching them. It's like their mind explodes. But to us, it's just a given. But that's because we've been conditioned to think like that for 500 years.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, it's a couple of things that we've touched on before on the podcast, where like people with just like you said, with more Spaniard features or whatever, they se creen más, like in, especially in Mexico, especially today, like even when they get here, even my family that now lives here, like, and have been here for such a long time, they're still like this idea of mejorando la raza, and I'm always like, first of all, no.
Yes, no.
But it's, yeah, it's very, very prevalent.
It is very prevalent, but I also think that a lot of our ideas, race ideas, come from the States. So you can, having money and being brown in Mexico is not a weird thing. You know what I'm saying? So again, yes, color, the color of your skin has a lot to do with your social status in many ways. But again, it's all about social status. So you can be prieto, 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 and have a shed load of money. And your prejudices will, like, will go away because of money. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what they do say, like, at certain time, at a certain point, certain artists or whatever, whenever they get enough money, they're basically just white.
Yeah. So, why, for example, why Latinos... privilege in the States is not necessarily the same as white Latinos in Latin America. It's two different things. Yes, it has a lot to do with it, but it's two different things. And that's the problem here in the States, that we keep talking about race in Latin America with this basic binary system. But the reality is that in Mexico, it's so much more complicated than that. So much more. So, for example, in my classes, we spend sometimes a month just talking about the caste system and race and how it functions. Because, for example, the Inquisition came to Mexico to just to make sure that everybody was Christian, more specifically Jews. But they didn't have right over indigenous people, because indigenous people were in a way protected because they were enslaved in other forms, you know. And if you were accused of being Jewed and you look Jewish, whatever that means, you will go on trial in the Inquisition, and all of a sudden you start speaking Nahuatl or Maya.
Yeah.
Or Quiche. And
so they want to pass as...
And even though you might look white, you might look con pelo chino, whatever you want, if you start speaking that language, they're like, oh, he's an indigenous person.
Right.
Your color and your phenotype had nothing to do with it.
That's one of the things that caught me off guard on Juana Diaz, the show on Netflix, because she comes in and she impresses the shit out of all these Spaniards, like out of nowhere.
And she's mestiza, she's Creole.
Right, and she's like, starts speaking in Nahuatl, and like, they're like, don't ever do that, it's offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, that's the language of this country. Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
So, Juana Inés is a show on Netflix.
I always say Juana Díaz, it's Juana Inés.
Yeah, Juana Inés, No, it's a show on Netflix. I think it was produced by La Universidad Iberoamericana. So, in a way, academics and scholars of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz put together that show.
And it reflects.
Yes.
Heavily.
And do you know that they just discovered, like 5 years ago or so, they discovered a series of poems that Sor Juana Inés wrote to the Vice Queen?
The which one?
La Segunda. La Segunda. Con la que estaba enamorada.
Oh, so maybe that's why they're like, oh, that's enough drama for a television
show. So a lot of the dialogue is based on those poems.
Wow.
So they read the poems and translated them, and I don't know, how do you call it, when you transfer it from the actual literature to a script. They adapted it.
They adapted it, right.
Yeah. That's why it's so juicy.
It's intense. Like, you don't know what to think throughout the whole show. Like, especially, like, her sexuality, because she's not supposed to have one, after, especially after she becomes a nun.
Yes.
It's so interesting how it's explored.
An advisor of mine refers to nuns as the third sex, because you are not supposed to be men, but you do have a little bit more rights within the convent than women, but you're also don't supposed to be woman. So it's like a really weird...
like an agender thing. That's, yes. Which is very interesting.
So like sometimes they refer to them as like drag queens, because, you know, like they're always on regalia. They're always wearing stuff. They're always performing a gender that in a way they have been assigned to, you know? So it's like a weird colonial drag queen thing. And also there's a lot of portraits, non-portraits that were created of hers, of nuns. Because sending your daughter to the convent was a big prestige. And just like there was a hierarchy and a caste system for humans and for people, so it was for nuns. So if you have a lot of money, you went with the Spanish nuns, the Carmelites or some of those. And if you had no money, you will go with indigenous nuns that had a bad reputation, for example. So if you notice in the show, she goes to one and they're too strict because they're the ones with a lot of money.
Yeah, they're hella strict.
So she goes to a second convent where they're a little bit more loose because they're not as prestigious as the first convent. So there was a hierarchy of nuns. You have to, just like the caste system, you had to have Spanish blood. Many times they're so prestigious that you own slaves. They don't show you that in the show that Sor Juana actually owned a slave.
Right, but they just barely touch on it because at one point they do want to like make it more strict. They want to make it more, I guess, quote unquote, prestigious. Mm-hmm. At one point, and they're like, "Yeah, you can no longer have servants," and they say it that way. They say servants, mm-hmm. and but you know what they mean. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then they're like, "No servants." Like you can see them being appalled at it.
Yeah.
And you're like, "Bitch, let them go."
Yeah. And that's the thing about there's so many things in Mexico from the colonial period that you just don't talk about. Like the conquest was, it's shameful still for people. So you can go to Mexico, you'll see monuments for Moctezuma, this and that, but you won't see monuments for Cortes. You won't see ideas about it. There's still some rich people that romanticize the conquest because it's the union between the Spanish and the indigenous people. But for the most part, that's a part of history that gets erased. The Inquisition, you won't find traces of the Inquisition when the Inquisition actually conducted some of its most intense years in Mexico. There's this thing called autos de fe, which is an act of faith, which is a public performance of power. So the Inquisition will enact its laws upon a person that's gonna die or be killed or murdered or burned or whatever in public. So they will set up a stage, everybody will come from town and be like, you and you are gonna die because you're a bigamist or whatever. And then after that, a procession followed to the park and then they died. The biggest auto de fe recorded to date happened in Mexico. And a stage was built for 36,000 people, just to give you an idea.
Jesus.
Over 30,000 people. It was in the 1630s, 1660, something like that. And it was such a big event that people from the Philippines came, people from Europe came, people from South America. So the Inquisition had a huge presence in Mexico. But just like slavery, just like the conquest, just like the Inquisition, Mexico has erased that part of its history. And it shows, because none of that makes it into the show. If you have to know the colonial period to understand certain things, but they never elaborate on any of that.
Yeah, that's for sure. They, I mean, Juana Inés in particular, they concentrate on basically just feminism, just like mm-hmm. how they treat women in general, which right. I don't know if you want to get into a little bit more sure. about Juana Inés. Mm-hmm. What I know about Juana Inés is what I saw in the show, which I'm yeah. pretty sure was exaggerated many times.
No, one of the things that I appreciate about this show is that I think in Mexico, Juana Inés is one of the few icons we have from the colonial period. We get La Malinche, La Virgen de Guadalupe, Juana Inés, right? Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And we have this romantic idea that Sor Juana Inés was so unique that she was actually allowed to write and she had a lot of power and wara wara la cuchara. But the reality is that she fucking struggled. So the fact that they always hiding she's hiding her books, she's struggling, the fact that the queen is like smuggling her fucking books to Spain so she can publish them there. Those are things that we don't necessarily hear in school. We just hear that she's like the great El Fénix de Mexico or something like that they call it. But we never hear about those struggles because at the end of the day, you're right. She's a woman and she's a woman writer and she's a woman intellect. And that's a big no-no. Hence is her more favorite famous poet. Like, hombres necios que acusáis a la mujer, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's one of the last poems. I think the show opens with that and closes with that. Mm. It talks about how she's not allowed to do anything because she's a woman at the end of the day. And it's so interesting, her relationship with Inquisitor. See how they don't tell you about the Inquisition, but it's all about the relationship between her and the Inquisitor.
Right.
At all times, she's vigilada. So Juana Inés used to write poems against the government. and perform them in front of them. And the government, the viceroy, will be too stupid to understand.
Yeah.
Because she will combine allegories of gods from Rome and Greece with allegories of Nahuatl deities.
Yeah.
So she will create this very elaborate plays that basically criticize the government. And you have to understand also that in the late 1600s, it's a period of torment in Mexico. There's a scene that they show you that the local peoples, the native peoples of Mexico City, are up in arms. They burn part of the palace of the governors in Mexico City. So the turmoil is crazy. The only successful revolution against the Spanish happened, not the only one, but one of the successful revolutions against the Spanish happens in 1680. And that resonated around the world because the people from New Mexico, from the southwest of the states, kicked out the Spanish, and that freaked the fuck out. So everybody is anxious.
Right.
Everybody is anxious about indigenous people in Mexico. And here you have this bitch who's writing about the beauty of being both Spanish and indigenous, and she does it with her writings. So it's a big no-no. It's super dangerous. And in fact, thanks to Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, her friend, Góngora, which comes out a lot, those are two thinkers that in a way planted the seed for the independence over 100 years later, because they are writing about being proud of coming from Spanish heritage, but being from Mexico. So they write about that. They write about the pride of being Creole, again, from Spanish descendancy, but born in Mexico. They write about the beauty of indigenous cultures in Mexico. That's the first time that happens, because normally that's separated. So those, we call them Creole sentiments. So the Creole sentiments that finally led to 1810, a group of people that said, fuck you, Spain, get out, and led to the independence, starts right here in the where the show takes place. So the independence wasn't created in a year. The independence happened over a period over 100 years. And that's why she is accepted by the government as an icon, because thanks, she's like the la primera Mexicana proud, basically. So she has a lot to do with the independence of Mexico, even though she lived 100 years before. But that sort of historical context really is shown in the show, but they don't explain it, which is it's hard. So when you go back and watch it again, it's even more exciting, because you know that there's too much. Like, the government is anxious. Being proud of anything indigenous is subversive. So, and on top of everything, she still did her shit and she still did her thing. She's a badass. She's such a badass.
Yeah, it's like, that's the one thing that I did get out of that show. Is like, this girl, even like from the start of the show, which is, she's like maybe like 15 or 16 at the time, she gets kicked out. Like, she's not only is she forced to be independent, but she's probably like the best at being independent. Like, she immediately takes things into her own hands.
Yeah.
And like, she's not afraid.
Correct.
So it's just she was a certain kind of person that you had to be like her in order to do what she did. Like,
right.
Not just her brains, but like her guts.
Su carácter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so beautiful, because we live in an era where we flaunt our pride of being Latinx. And for most of us, being Latinx gets reduced to a few icons, aka Frida Kahlo, or just a couple of things that we're proud of, right?
Right.
But when you understand the history of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, when you look at the history of when she was born and how she developed and how she was able to publish, you realize that we as people owe a lot to the colonial period. The colonial period, it was a horrible period of 300 years of oppression, but it's something that we cannot deny. We are, you can call it victims of colonization, but we're not going to erase the colonial period. So this idea of let's decolonize this, it's unreal. We can do things that are anti-colonial and protest and resist, especially in a government that, like the one that we live today, but we cannot erase the colonial period. We are product of it. We need to accept it and move on, right? And Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, I feel like it's the perfect entry of how people have been resisting for hundreds and hundreds of years. And she is a product of colonialism. As much as you hate it, as much as some people want to go back to the pre-Columbian period, which was also very problematic, and it was also stratified, and it was also violent as hell. As much as we want to do that, we can't. 300 years fucked us all up, and we're still dealing with the consequences. So let's learn about that. Let's learn about how all that shit happened, and hopefully we can move forward. And we can continue doing things anti-colonial, not decolonial. I'm trying to not use those words anymore. Right.
Mm-hmm. That's a really important thing to bring up, too, because we, and even me, like, I like to make a lot of jokes about, like, the Spanish influence that we have.
Yeah.
And, like, but you're right. Like, everybody's just kind of like, oh, full rejection. Like, fully reject this whole Spanish thing. But it's
utopic.
Ingrained.
Yeah. Yeah. It's utopic. I mean, yes, we can try to reject anything Spanish, but start with the language.
Yeah, I know. Like,
our skin. What are you gonna do? Our phenotypes, our food, everything is embedded in what happened in the colonial period. And just to say that it was just an oppressive period, it's also a disservice to the pre-Columbian our heritage, because again, natives never stopped resisting. You know, when you know the Aztec calendar, the big Aztec, Aztec calendar, which is also a symbol of the nation, right?
Right.
When it was first discovered, it was discovered in the 1770s, 1760s, 1780s in Mexico. It was an urn. It was put on, it was mounted onto an actual tower of the Cathedral of Mexico City, together with another important statue. The name of the statue is Coatlicue. Coatlicue means serpent skirt, she of serpent skirt. And when you look at Coatlicue, she is like 4 meters high. She's a gigantic, monstrous stone. Beautiful, but very monstrous. So they discovered those gigantic pieces under the Cathedral of Mexico City, and they left it out there for people to see. People go to bed. Then they wake up the next night. Coatlicue and the Aztec calendar is filled with flowers and with candles. So this is in 1780s. Cortes arrived in 1519. We're talking about over 200 years, and people still believe and have memories of the pre-Columbian period. So as much as we say the colonial period is just a period of 300 years, the reality is that people resisted, and a lot of our creencias and a lot of our culture coexisted and survived that period. So I'm not saying let's embrace the colonial period, because that's problematic as fuck. But let's learn about the colonial period so we can better understand who we are, and we can better try to undo and create anti-colonial gestures that hopefully will bring a change.
That's freaking good advice that I think that we really need to hear at this point, because we're kind of going all over the place.
Yes, we are.
A little bit. not me and you, but like, you know, in general, as a community, the Latinx community. The one thing that I want to know, because I didn't learn about Juana Inés ever, because I only was schooled in public school system in Texas, which is fucked up for another 100 reasons.
Yeah.
And I didn't learn about her until basically watching this show and doing a little bit of research here and there. Mm-hmm. So where did you learn about her?
I learned it through school, and I'm not even... that versed on Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. I read some of her poems. I learned about her in my colonial literature class that I took in UNM. I learned her through art history, because she was friends with Góngora, who's another writer, but she was also friends with Correa and Villalpando, which are two of the most important artists in Mexican history, because they are Creole artists, because they're making art with that Creole sentiment that is going to lead to the independence. So one thing that was really exciting about the show is that when the new viceroy comes in, they built this arch.
Yeah.
And she's part of the committee that builds the arch. And the arch will be made out of carton, I think, like wood and stuff. It wasn't permanent. But it will be like a triumphal arch, very similar to the ones that were created when the Romans will win a war. It's almost like a trophy. But the arches, They were made with canvases, with paintings, and the paintings will have allegories. So instead of an opera or instead of a poem, Juan Correa and Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz and Góngora, the three of them designed the paintings and the allegories. So Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, and she was versed on everything. She knew everything. She yeah. was a truly Renaissance woman. She knew art. In fact, if you look at her most famous portrait, you know, like the portrait that made it all the way to the, I think, Los Billetes de 200 Pesos in yeah. Mexico, that was a painting created in the 1750s, 1760s by the most famous Mexican artist. His name was Miguel Cabrera. Had a huge workshop. And in that painting, she's shown not reading, which is common with when you have women portraits. Like, they're not allowed to write, but they're allowed to read, right? She's actually with, con su pluma, en el libro. She's writing, and she's in a library.
Yeah.
So very much like St. Matthew and some of this, the writers of the Bible, the way that they portrayed, that's how Cabrera decided to portray Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And in the back, you have all those books, and among those books is a treatise of painting. So even though she wasn't a painter herself, she knew all about painting. And that translated on the fact that she was assigned to create probably one of the most important commissions of the time, this gigantic arch.
Right.
So that's why I know a lot about her because she created that triumphal arch that welcomed the viceroy. So I think he will come in. And when that happened, the whole entire city will dress up. People would throw textiles over their balconies, como adornando la ciudad, fireworks, allegorical arches, etc., etc. So la ciudad entera se vestía de fiesta, you know? And learning about the city as a stage for Baroque performances like that, that's how I understood the importance of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, yeah.
Yeah, I noticed, because you said this was a joint project, and obviously there's no way she could have done it by herself. But in the show, the whole time it's like, oh, Juana Inés did yes. this. And like they go around, and then immediately the viceroy's wife is like, I have to meet this woman.
Yes, because her invisibility made her visible. Because mm-hmm. people knew about her and sus escritos atrevidos. To the point that she was controlled by the Inquisition so much, but it's not like she was giving interviews on TV right. or like she wasn't a public figure because she was in the convent. So that increased that increased her visibility.
And they did portray her, and I don't know if this is like, obviously we have no way of knowing if this was actually how it was, but they portrayed her as very much like into it. Like she wanted people to see her work. Mm-hmm. She wanted to impress people, despite the fact that, I mean, obviously before she had any attention on her, like she learned for herself, like she just loved it. She loved to write and she loved to read, but like they portrayed her as this person who just was like, oh, did they see the arch, like, you know, how mm-hmm. how did they react to the arch, who's talking about it, you know yeah. what I mean? And then they very heavily concentrated on her, like her romances or lack of romances, more like unwanted advances sometimes yeah. in the stories. And I'm curious how much of that is told when they teach you about one of the
ladies. None of that, because in a way, there's a whole realm of academia devoted to Sor Juana. Like they call them los Sor Juanistas. Wow. They have conferences and everything. Oh, yeah. So, but the reality is that a lot of the information we have of her is through her poetry. And writing poetry is like writing history. You have to take it with a grain of salt. And there's so many filters in between truth and what we read that it's only interpretations.
Right.
So I don't know exactly the kind of documentation that somebody will have to do in order to recreate some of those scenes. But given the fact that I know that a lot of Sor Juanistas were in charge of this project of the Netflix show, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of that is very close to the actual truth. But it requires exhaustive, how do you call it, archival work. Because letters between the Sor Juana y la Virreina, Letters between Gorgora and Sor Juana, the Inquisitor, all of that, if it survives, they're probably used to reconstruct that.
Right.
And plus, there were movies. Yo la peor de todas. I think there one a Spanish movie called like that, Yo la peor de todas, which I think that's what she wrote. She signed with her blood towards the end of her life. Yo la peor de todas.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So that's an actual famous scene, famous phrase. She's like, yeah, I'm the worst of all. Like, I'm the worst of the worst. I'm a woman, you know. I'm a writer. I'm this. I'm a nun. So, yeah.
That's amazing. I don't know. At first, I was really creeped because I was like, even though I honestly, anytime that people call out the bullshit about like how children are treated sometimes, especially even today, honestly, but where they get abused and all this stuff, I'm like, yes, call it out and fuck them up. But I was upset at the same time because I'm like, later on they go ahead and they portray her as a queer woman. That's pretty much she has like one relationship with a man, which goes horribly wrong. And then like, so I was like, damn, what the fuck are they saying? But then I was like, you know what, this is it. They never make it about like, oh, her being gay. They just make it about no matter what, no matter who she would have gotten involved with at that point, it would have been wrong because she was a nun.
She, porque era la peor de todas, right? And that's the beauty about this show, that it's happening now. Because if this show was written 20 years ago, all of that shit would have been erased. So there's ideas that people will have because of the movie, I think, of her queerness. But I think in a way, at least in the popular imagination, this show helps solidify that. I told you, my mom watched that shit, and she was into it. She's like, ay, pobrecita Sor Juana, and this and that. I'm like, yeah. And it's so cool because people don't want to engage with any popular culture that makes references to the colonial period because the idea is that it's boring.
No.
Pero el pedo es que era un novelón. Like, they was fucking a big-ass soap opera, anything. That's what I was talking to my boo. Like, we were trying to find all the movies that refer in the of La Época de Oro del Cine, you know, 1940s, 1950s. That referred to the colonial period, because we watched Macario. I don't know if you've seen that movie. It's not queer, but it's Mexican. But it's a movie about this guy who gained special powers to the point that even the king wants to use them to cure the daughter. And it's a beautiful movie shot by the best cinematographer in Mexican history, Gabriel Figueroa. And I was like, I'm hooked. Like, this is a big ass soap opera because it involves the viceroy, it involves indigenous people and ideas of curanderos, just like everything that we think about Mexican all together in one show, in one movie. But then I started thinking, like, how many movies of the colonial period? Because there's some crazy shit that happened in the colonial period. Nothing. I think there's one called La Santa Inquisición or El Santo Oficio by Ripstein. I think that was in the 70s. There is a soap opera with Lucia Mendez called Diana Salazar. It's about a witch who's persecuted by the Inquisition. That shit is good.
That's interesting.
But I'm going to say 10 movies of the of the colonial period were made in a period of 70 years.
Damn.
And when you think of other periods of history, especially the Revolution, because the revolution, the ideals of the revolution, of the supposed democratic ideals of the revolution were promoted so much. There's probably, you can probably find over 100 movies on the revolution in a period of 20 years. But the colonial period, there's so much material there. There's so much material for some crazy ass shit.
Right.
Gay and non-gay. So good.
Yeah, I'm interested because, like, you know, we have a lot of, now that there's kind of this new, like, a surge of wanting, you know, supposedly diverse media, you know, everybody's wanting all these things, but they want to see themselves now. They want to see very specific things, everybody wants to see themselves in their own lives, which is not going to happen, but it'd be really cool. Like, let's take it back a minute. How do we get here? You know what I mean? Like, let's take it back and go to the colonial period and then view it through the lenses of people that are educated, you know what I mean, instead of biased. I think that we could definitely go back and create some shit now.
Yeah,
now
we know better. I think there's so much, but it also requires a lot of work.
Yeah.
Because, for example, to write another movie of the revolution will be relatively easy because we have been exposed to movies of the revolution so many times. But to write a new script about the colonial period will require a lot of research. And many people fail because, again, it requires a lot of work. It's like writing a dissertation, like writing a book. But that's not how cinema or TV works. Like, you have to produce, you know, you have to produce.
But people have written dissertations. I feel like, you know, we just need to put our shit together and work with these academics. I don't think that's a problem at all.
And good example is Sor Juana. I feel like that was a committee. I don't know. I need to do my research, but I feel like that was a committee of a lot of scholars that understood the colonial period. I mean, to the point that, for example, in one of the first scenes, you had somebody dragging victims in a horse, and they were dressed in sanbenitos. And that dress, those sanbenitos, those are the type of garments that people had to wear for life when they were condemned by the Inquisition. There's another scene where you have folding screens that separate different rooms. You see it in one of the first scenes with con la Virreina. Mm-hmm. And those came from Japan, and they were decorated in Mexico with Mexican paintings, and they made it into the show. So there's a lot of little aspects about the material culture that they understood. They're like, oh, this is colonial, and this is how we're going to do it. So even when the production is very low, you can tell that there's not a lot of money to do the show.
Only 7 episodes.
Right. Even with that, they still were able to include a lot of little details. And I'm telling you this, I've seen a lot of things that involve the colonial period, and I always get disappointed. And so is my advisor. I asked my advisor, he wouldn't watch it. And finally, like a year later, he texts me, and he's like, oh my God, it's so good. Like, I'm going to have my students watch this.
Wow.
That's how good that show is. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't fuck around, man. Like, mm-hmm. it does focus a lot on romance and stuff like that, but it seems to me like real.
It is, and it also catches you. Girl, at the end of, like, at the last episode, I was standing up against the TV. I wasn't just watching from my couch. I was so nervous. My heart was beating so fast. I'm like, I know she's going to die, but what's going to happen? Like, I was so nervous because the way they construct it almost becomes suspense. Oh, it's a brilliant show. It's really one of the best shows I've seen in the past 10 years. Because of that. I mean, I've seen great shows, you know. Mm-hmm. Luis Miguel is one of them. You don't have to get into
it. I apparently have to watch this, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's like the opposite of gay.
Okay.
But it's so fucking good. But anyway, so I've seen a lot of shows, right? But Sor Juana just hit every spot. It hit my gay spot. It hit my historical spot. It hit my artsy spot, my poetic spot. Good cinematography, even though the production is very low, and great fucking research.
Yeah, definitely. It fills all those boxes.
Yes. No pun intended. Oh, all the puns intended.
Yeah, there's at least one pun intended. Oh my God, I really enjoyed that show, and I actually ended up getting somebody super random into it. Like, I was just watching it, they started watching it with me. They're obsessed. They finished it before I did. I was like, well, I'm the master binger. Okay.
Yes.
I don't know. I guess the last comment that I really have, when it comes to Juana Inez, I know that this is not the reason that she chose to go to a convent. She really didn't have that much of a choice when it came to going to the convent. But it's so interesting to me. Another thing that you could do on the queer side of things is, like, obviously, if you were to have to choose between having to marry some douchebag back in the day, mm-hmm. or go to a convent, every lesbian is gonna go to the fucking convent.
Yes.
So shit had to go down there, like, just like statistically speaking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
there's a really good book. There's, like, I need to find it, but there's like this anthology of nun writings throughout Spain and the Americas, mm-hmm. and I feel like that will give you an introduction, because the study of nuns and as cultural producers is very interesting. There's a lot of people writing about it. But one of the things about the convent, even though, yes, like, fuck, man, let's go to the convent, is that the convent, the way that they were organized, was also a microcosm of outside. Mm-hmm. So they were not allowed to go outside, but just like the outside world is stratified according to class and gendered and color and all of that, the same thing inside the convent. So, for example, in the rich convents, you had the rich nuns on one part of the convent, the poor nuns on the other part of the convent. If you graduated and you made it to the next step, then you can go to the other side.
Wow.
There's a lot of stories about them having abortions.
Yeah.
And there's fantastic stories, which part of me believes them, but I don't want to concentrate on that, on how many times they will have abortions and they will hide them in the walls. So, like, you still go to Mexico, for example, next convento de Santa Monica, and there's stories of the walls actually have corpses of babies that they have discovered.
That's terrifying, but it's also very telling of even our society today, because everybody's all pro-life and all this crap, and nobody wants to accept the fact that pro-life doesn't mean more people are saved. It just means, like, people are getting unsafe abortions.
Right.
And this has been going on since literal nuns in a convent. I mean, guys, come on, just freaking let abortion happen.
I know, fuck. There's also, they were not allowed to shower.
Jesus.
So if they were showered, they had to be supervised by people, and they had to be wearing a garment. Mm-hmm. And it was garment upon garment, because living in the convent was supposed to fulfill certain ideas about poverty, and pain. And the more your life resembled the life of Christ on the cross, the better you were.
Right.
So you had to suffer. You have to, tienes que pasar hambre. You had to suffer. You weren't allowed to shower. And when you finally had to shower, it would be for health reasons or only once a month. I mean, the rules changed from convent to convent, but it was like, it was brutal. Like, being in a convent was a brutal thing. And they show that aspect of convent life in Sor Juana through her pain, the pain that she went through for writing. Mm-hmm. But they don't really show you, like,
the green aspect. Yeah, they don't show you the hygiene at all.
Yeah, and I mean, and again, every convent was different. And I'm assuming that those rich convents had, a better life. Yeah, but... Yeah. Everything was, they're always praying. Everything around a convent, all the paintings that are created are to remind them of their positions, of the liminal positions between heaven and earth. And it's just so many aspects. But just because of that, you also have probably had amazing fucking crazy soap operas that occurred that are just waiting to be written into movies.
Yeah, I want the Mexican nun version of Downton Abbey immediately.
It's probably written already. Somebody just needs to adapt it.
Yeah, yeah. That's very true.
That would be good.
I know.
With sexy nuns and shit. Oh, that would be so good. Yeah. That would be so good. Yeah, again, the colonial period is, because it's so oppressive and so fucked up, there's so many good things that, I mean, almost anything made you a subversive person. Speaking now, when you were Spanish blood, made you a subversive person. So imagine all the stories that were written. So,
Man, that's something for me to ponder on. I'm about to change my whole pilot.
And anything, I mean, and that also goes to your listeners, if they're interested on that, maybe I can send you some links where introduction to the colonial period. There's a great website called Vistas. And it's just like you click on the website and they're just different links to different aspects of the colonial period. There's also a really good resource. And these are just introductory resources for anything from high school to like grad school. Khan Academy, I wrote two articles for them. And they're just like a two-page article or one-page article. And has a lot of photography in it. I wrote about Franciscans because that's what I do. But also there's like a really cool video about the portrait of Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz. So you can learn about her without having to read an entire book. I mean, if you're just curious and you're not going to like major on this, Khan Academy and Vistas, which I don't know if you have show notes.
I do.
I can send them to you.
That would be great. Mostly because I want them for myself. But
down.
Yes.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Well, I'm going to do a little quick in the fashion of Latinos Who Lunch. Yes. Do you have anything that you want to recommend regarding our topics on this episode? Maybe people want to learn more about just colonialism in general.
Yes, I think, again, those two websites are really good introductions. There's another one, I have to think about it, I think it's Colonial Mexico, but I think Khan Academy is the best, because Khan Academy is like an art history website, and they have everything now. But they really try to diversify what they have. So they actually, for example, when they write about La Virgen de Guadalupe, it's two scholars traveling to Mexico, being in front of the image of the Virgen de Guadalupe and talking about it and recording it.
Wow.
So it's like a podcast.
Yeah.
And each episode is like 3 minutes and it's different art pieces. So you can learn about Casta paintings, which were produced in that period when Spain wanted to show that they're better than everybody else, et cetera, et cetera. And it gives you a really good introduction and shows you that the colonial period is very crazy, messed up, but also very, very interesting. And it reveals a lot of her truths. So again, Khan Academy, K-A-H-N Academy. And
like
then,
the ethical philosopher.
Yes, and Vistas. And they are, I consider them peer reviewed because they go through a process of editors. But the final product is not heavy ass academic shit. It's something that, I mean, I use videos all the time. And I know my, probably it's, that's not the right way to approach a classroom, but I will talk for 30 minutes and then I show a 10 minute video and then I talk about it for another 30, 40 minutes in another video. So you can do it from your home.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of Sor Juana, I think that will, going into those two websites will give you other resources also to keep researching on the show. And also I forgot the name of the company that made it, but Google Sor Juana Inés TV show and
it's on Netflix
and Universidad Iberoamericana.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a little bit more of an insight of the scholars that actually work, because I should have done my research, but I'm sure doing those Googles will lead you into the scholars that participated. Maybe they have some books that you're interested.
Or shit, maybe they're producing something else.
Or maybe they're looking at that. Because actually, La Iberoamericana produced really good shows. There's one called Soy Tu Fan. I binge watched that in like a week. And there's 2 seasons. And it's just like this girl who falls in love with a psychologist. She's in her late 20s and she's finishing her thesis. So it's all about the traumas of finishing her thesis. And she's just like biking around Mexico City with her hipster friends. It's just like so basic, but so good. Because to me, they were my friends. All of those characters were people that I grew up with when I was in la secundaria in Juarez. And there's another show, I forgot the name of it. And some of the people that put their money into it is, ¿cómo se llama el que sale, the Mexican que sale in Star Wars?
Diego Luna
produced those shows.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And there's another one about a photographer that drops his boyfriend for somebody in England. She moves and comes back, and it's all the drama behind it. But the characters are so down to earth. They're not your typical, like, I'm a Mexicano, arriba, arriba. Like, they're just people living in a big city, you know?
And we need that.
And those are the same production company. This is the same production company. Forgot the name of it, that produced Sor Juana Inés. I mean, Juana Inés de la Cruz. So again, Vistas, Khan Academy, and anything produced by them. And I'm sure there's already something new. I haven't checked in a while, so I'm sure they already have a show in the works or something out there.
Yeah. Especially after the, I mean, I guess I don't know that it's been that successful, but it should be successful, Juana Inés.
In Mexico was very successful.
That's good. Okay, cool.
And Soy Tu Fan was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Soy Tu Fan was huge in Mexico. I watch it on YouTube, so.
Okay, for sure. Well, then I'll definitely put up all those links. Where else can we find you? The podcast, Latinos Who Lunch. If you're not already listening to them, what are you doing?
Get your shit together.
they're on all the regular streaming podcast formats. Yeah. But where can we find you on social media?
So I'm Babelito on
Instagram.
On Instagram, I'm Babelito666 or Babelito666 in Twitter. That's it. I quit Facebook because it made me hate the world.
Yeah.
I still hate the world, but I hate it a little bit less because I don't have Facebook. And that's it. Instagram and Twitter, I'm less active. So Instagram is my shit. So I have a lot of listeners who reach out to me. They're like, hey, can you recommend a book? And I answer right away. So I will say, yes, Instagram.
Awesome. And then Latinos Who Lunch, I think it can be found at
everywhere.
Latinos Who Lunch everywhere.
You can also send us questions at asklwlpod@gmail.com. And also we are at all the platforms as Latinos Who Lunch.
And then go spam them if you want them to be on our show again. And then that's how we'll know.
Yes, yes. I can wait. I mean, I'm back. I'm moving to Chicago, but I'll be back for a month in December. And hopefully by in a year from now, I will have a job here in LA. So
I hope so.
I will be here and we can do this a lot more often.
And I'll go take your classes.
Down.
Down. Okay. Thank you so much for being on the show. This has been really informative and like freaking awesome.
I hope I didn't bore your audience because I was just like, la, 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 colonial, la, 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 la.
They
la,
better
la.
Not be bored because I wasn't bored. And oh, I good. Have pristine taste, obviously. So
thank you so much, Maite. And shout out to your show, man. So good. I'm excited.
Gracias. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And if you want, guys want to follow us on social media, it's at CYC Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, CYC Pod on Facebook. Our Patreon is CYC Podcast. And my personal is NYC Panda. Fried Papita is on everything.
Shout out, Fried Papita. We miss you.
Yeah. Sorry that she wasn't in this episode. I know she's your fave for some of you guys. But we have Pavelito, who is fantastic. And you guys will definitely hear her next week. So thank you so much once again for being on the show. And bye, guys.
Ciao.